Content warning: the following podcast contains discussion of sexual assault and religious persecution.
You're watching Channel 37, WHXN, New Salem.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show does battle with God's instrument on Earth. First up, Christopher Lee most decidedly does not forget to be awesome in Rasputin, the Mad Monk. Then, we've got more Vincent Price than you can handle in Witchfinder General.
Hello and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Dave.
Hello.
Wendy.
Hey there.
And Will.
Rah, rah, Rasputin. I'm not going to say the rest.
I accept the challenge!
Russia's greatest love machine.
Yes, Dave, you chose this week, and what did you bring us?
I brought to the fine people of this parish.
Yeah.
Rasputin the Mad Monk.
Evil. All powerful. All terrifying. Evil to seek you out and destroy. Guys and gals alike, disguise yourself from the most inhuman creatures ever to frighten the wits out of you. Get your Rasputin beard free as you enter the theater to see Rasputin the Mad Monk!
Awesome.
Was this anybody's... this was my first time seeing it. Was this anybody else's?
My first time.
Mine.
So everybody but Dave. Okay, cool. Dave, would you mind giving us a quick run-through of Rasputin the Mad Monk?
Certainly. So Rasputin the Mad Monk is the heartwarming tale of how Grigory Ivanovich Rasputin went from apparently notable drunken hellraiser to quack physician and, of course, his journey to becoming the greatest love machine of Russia. But does receive a comeuppance. A hell of a comeuppance.
Indeed. Yeah, the actual story is not super complicated.
Yeah, like if you've heard of Rasputin and you know anything about Rasputin, apparently there were disclaimers at the start of the film when it first screened saying this is not an historical representation, mainly because there were still people alive who were mentioned in this film. Because that's how close, yeah, it's one of those things, like, you tend to think of, like, Rasputin and Russia as being sort of, like, years ago. It's like a different world. But, yeah, there were people still alive when this film came out who knew Rasputin. There may have been people alive when this film came out who actually killed Rasputin.
Yeah, Prince Yusupinov was still alive when this came out, and they couldn't use his name.
So, yes. Yeah, it's a hell of a tale.
Indeed. Why did you pick this one?
I stumbled across this I own a large kind of 20 film Hammer box set, which I started making my way through film by film. I was writing about them for a while on the old Geek Planet online website, and a column I wittily called Stop Hammer Time. So I was making my way through sort of like basically all the films in this box set in the order that, you know, they came out of the box really. And so I'd never heard of this before, gave it a watch, and it's a hell of a Christopher Lee performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the opposite of what you like. When you think of a Christopher Lee performance, you tend to think of sort of stoic, controlled, kind of patrician, you know. And this is kind of like the opposite of that. This is pure unleashed Christopher Lee. This is the Christopher Lee who go on to make death metal albums with Norwegian rock bands. You know. He's a completely different beast here, almost unrecognizable beneath the kind of enormous beard. And he's just like a force of nature in this film. It's like, you know, dancing like a maniac, laughing like an absolute nutter. He has a series of outlandish costumes to the point where if they made a series of action figures connected to this film, I would buy them. Because you have Tavern Hellraiser Rasputin, you have Monk Rasputin. Physician Rasputin, which I think is one of my personal favourites, and sort of like a disco silk shirt Rasputin.
Scarlet seduction robes Rasputin.
That outfit is the best.
It is. It's really amazing, isn't it?
It looks like the costume of the dancer you hire for your kids' Romanov-themed birthday party.
Yeah. Like, for those of you who watched Batman 66, you remember sort of like Olga, Queen of the Cossacks. It says like her henchmen used to dress a lot like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so obviously, yeah, it's sort of weird because it's almost the closest Hammer ever came to making a biopic. Insofar that Rasputin was a real person that existed, but obviously some massive liberties have been taken with the historical accuracy.
It's a Hammer biopic, so it has to have the prerequisite amount of de-limmings and face meltings with acid.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a strange beast, but it's kind of really it's mainly like. The main reason for watching this is just watching a very different Christopher Lee performance than you would usually be expecting from Christopher Lee. And he's amazing. He absolutely holds this together. He kind of like really embodies the hypnotic charisma that a lot of people say kind of Rasputin possessed. And yeah, he's fantastic. I mean, this is a Hammer film, so there's a quality list of British character actors supporting this, including the great Francis Matthews, Captain Scarlet himself. And of course, the wonderful Barbara Shelley, who is always kind of like, she's a Hammer regular and is always fantastic in everything she's in as the kind of poor doomed lady in waiting to the Tsarina. It's a lot of fun just seeing kind of like an unleashed Christopher Lee and, there's kind of not a huge amount to say about it in terms of opening comments, just because if you want to see Christopher Lee dancing around and getting into drinking contests with random fellas and stuff, then, this is the film for you.
All right, cool. Thank you very much. How about Wendy? Other than the fact that we had people dressed in, 19th century Victorian-era Parisian costumes from time to time, what did you think of this movie?
Oh, my God, this movie was amazing. It was so much fun, right? So, Rasputin is somebody who actually existed, and I'm familiar with his story and the fall of the Romanovs and his role in that. And so every now and then I would get really angry, like, this timeline is too compressed. This isn't how it happened. Why does the Tsarina have no jewels on? She should be diamond encrusted. But oh my God, was this fun. Like, Christopher Lee was clearly having a fucking ball in this role, right? There's so much dancing and drinking and seducing women, and it's just the most fun movie about a fucking maniac that I've ever seen, right? His journey, from being the weird guy out in the village, drinking all the wine, working with the I forget what they call him, but little Alexei, the little doomed, never quite the czar, was just intense and wild. And I loved all the wardrobe changes. They were just fantastic. And this is just the most fun I think this is the most fun Hammer movie I've ever seen, right? And it didn't end in a fire.
No, this one ends with a dead Rasputin. So basically, when Rasputin is dead, we end the film.
Like, when we make the card game of the Hammer movie card game, the game enders. Like, we have a new card for game enders. And it's dead Rasputin in the snow. Yeah.
It's just Christopher Lee falls out a window.
He's just clearly having a ball. Right. And it was just such a fucking delight to watch. Yeah, I think that's my high level on this movie.
Okay, thank you. That's awesome. Will, how about yourself?
So I will say I do actually have a note, which is almost disappointed Rasputin didn't catch on fire or explode.
That would have been perfect if Francis Matthews had set him on fire and then thrown him out the window. That would have been perfect.
I will say I'm probably not as high in this film as everyone else is, but it But also, Christopher Lee is just like constantly entertaining, so the film is constantly entertaining, and it does the correct like poochy thing of whenever Rasputin's on screen, everyone should be saying, "Where's Rasputin?" I had a good enough time with the film. There are a few times that I feel like when Rasputin's not in a scene, it does kind of sort of drag a little bit, but then it's all servicing Rasputin showing up again. But yeah, no, and then it does do the hammer thing of where it just ends. Now they ran out of film, so it's like, cool, we're done. Rasputin gets thrown out of the window after getting poisoned and stabbed. Which, you know, they went light on Rasputin, all things considered, historically, because he didn't get shot, he didn't get drowned.
Yeah, he's way harder to kill in actual life.
Like, they could have had him get thrown out a window into a moat or something.
Well, to be fair, that yeah, the hammer budget only goes so far.
Yeah.
and they are the palace exterior stuff is also doubling for kind of Castle Dracula in Dracula, Prince of Darkness, which is being filmed at the same time as this.
But, like, overall, like, yeah, it's a... As a Christopher Lee vehicle, it's a terrific film. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, I mean, I'm right there with everybody else on this. When he's not on screen, it does slow down quite a bit. But I could never have imagined Christopher Lee in a role like this. Because, like you say, Dave, everything he does, he's stoic and quietly powerful. And here, he's an absolute maniac. He's just, you can't take your eyes off him when he's on screen. I love that they basically come out and say that he's got hypnotic powers, because why the fuck not, you know? If it gets things moving and gets, you know, gets his plans rolling, sure thing, you betcha. Yeah, he's absolutely incredible. Like Wendy said, he's very, very obviously having the absolute time of his life. And I'm a little surprised that he didn't do more stuff like this, when A, he's clearly so good at it, and B, he's so obviously having a good time doing it.
I would have honestly preferred him doing Count Dooku like this than just being a much lighter version of Saruman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, like unhinged sexual maniac Count Dooku would have been, actually would have probably made episode 2 a lot more watchable. No, he's fantastic. Like, there aren't enough superlatives in the world to tell you how amazing Christopher Lee is in this movie. And yeah, everybody else is just kind of making a Hammer film like they normally do. He's the only one who's off book.
And there are times where he is genuinely terrifying. I mean, like, what he does kind of turn it down for when he's stalking, is it Peter? The guy he kind of acids. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's kind of like Rasputin's made, yeah, like, convinced his sister to kill herself. So he sort of turned up looking for revenge, and, like, yeah, the lights are out, and basically Rasputin is stalking him in the darkness, and yeah, it's like, that's a really tense little scene. And there, kind of, like, Christopher Lee kind of turns it right the way back down again to kind of Christopher Lee classic, if you like. Yeah, just kind of like, just very measured, very slow, but like, he is a cat toying with its prey.
I'm going to be honest, though, other than Christopher Lee, I'm not sure I've got a lot to say about this one. He's incredible. And everything, I mean, it looks nice. It looks really nice.
I think Hammer's false beard budget went through the roof on this. Because, like, yeah, because I mean, not just Christopher Lee himself, but, like, I mean, it is another great thing about Hammer films when, yeah, you've got lots of locals with sort of very clearly glued on beards. Because, like, how else are you supposed to tell their yokels if they haven't got a big unkempt beard?
Yeah. they're Russian peasants. Of course they've got to have beards. We'll just take it out of the Tsarina's costuming budget.
And also, just like, it's fun just watching, you know, for kind of character actors turning up, like Joss Ackland is in this. Yeah, obviously he would go on to have a great kind of character actor career in Hollywood. For Doctor Who fans out there, Fenric is in this.
Yeah.
actor called Dinsdale Landon. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because, like, again, like you say about, I mentioned about the costumes being kind of a bit out of time for the period. I think, again, because they were basically double banking this with Dracula, Prince of Darkness, kind of like the costumes kind of have to do double duty. So the fact that sort of a lot of these places look quite, of a different part of Europe is mainly because they're meant for a different part of Europe. Like this was the B picture to the A picture that was like the sequel to Dracula. So you kind of get, there's going to be, like, this is the one they kind of knocked out to go with, what did this play with? I think this played with Plague of the Zombies and The Reptile, which filmed on the same sets as Plague of the Zombies, played with Dracula, Prince of Darkness. So basically, sort of out of sort of making two films for one, they got two double bills.
Yeah, the Roger Corman,
school, absolutely, yeah,
getting as much as you can out of your resources.
But yeah, like the cafe when Rasputin partakes of the drinking contest absolutely looks like a French bistro, complete with the music as well. It all looks very Parisian.
Yeah, the Tsarina, who only has one dress apparently, looks like she just stepped out of a Toulouse-Lautrec painting.
Yeah. Because, yeah, a lot of the Dracula, Prince of Darkness is, I mean, that's not French either. But it is more kind of classically European in its style. It's like, there's a thing that Hammer does, I think it's just sort of like generic Europe. Just sort of like, it's not a specific country, but like, you know, you get the vibe. And they sort of use that to transplant it anywhere for, sort of like, you know, it's not necessarily England, but it's not necessarily accurate of the place it's meant to be either.
Like Europlandia?
Yeah, but... Europlandia, basically.
Where the Christmas Prince lives.
Yes. Like, it always catches me off guard sometimes in the original Dracula, when everybody keeps, like, mentioning the fact that they're in Europe, and it's just kind of like, none of it's in England. It's just like, everybody looks and sounds really British. But all the place signs are in kind of Gothic lettering, and they're all in sort of like places like Romania and stuff. It's wonderfully ridiculous.
It's a little thing, but I love that there were actual signs on many of the buildings and streets. Like even when they were out in Siberia, both in the local language and English. Because not only are there many people who can speak and read English out there, all the peasants are clearly literate, and so everything has signs.
Yes, Hammer sort of confused Russia for Wales with its bilingual road signs.
Although, to kind of bring back to that point, I'm just trying to imagine Christopher Lee as Rasputin in The Christmas Prince.
Come to there.
That's a bad Christmas for everybody concerned.
that would indeed be fishy.
He'd turn up, cure the princess, the one who's got the disability. Like he'd cure her and like, you know, like sleep with everybody and throw the prince down the stairs. I mean, like, yeah, within the first, 20 minutes of this film, Rasputin has showed up, cured a woman who's suffering from fever, decided to throw a party, and then this other guy comes in. Who's like apparently some sort of, you know, is the sweetheart of the landlord's daughter, and obviously Rasputin is kind of getting her drunk, and he's kind of like, right, well, he basically wants to challenge Rasputin to a dance off. He's taking his jacket off, and I'll show them what real dancing's like. And he's turned around, and Rasputin doesn't care about that because he's now in the barn trying to sleeping with the woman who he's betrothed to. And then eventually he gets, like, he cuts someone's hand off, he gets threatened with farming implements, and then just escapes through the roof of a barn.
Yeah, and I mean, like the seduction of the bar owner's daughter turns into a sexual assault once he cuts off her boyfriend's hand. I mean, like, this is escalating fast.
Yeah, he doesn't quite understand that dismembering her love is sort of a bit of an ardor killer.
Well, he feels like he can probably just hypnotize her or something, and whatever. Yeah.
His escape through the roof, though, is amazing.
Oh, yeah. This is not the last you'll see of Rasputin!
Yeah, I feel like Feminist Monday is supposed to be talking about the his power over women and that sexual assault in the barn, and yeah, he was a bad dude. But it's really hard to not be behind this Christopher Lee interpretation of Rasputin. It's just amazing.
Just tricking people into throwing acid in their own face, which that was really good makeup there for the aftermath of the acid.
Yeah. I imagine there was a lot of very kind of shocked people coming out of the cinema after that, saying, "Oh my god."
If Hammer, I mean, it's like Hammer's wheelhouse, though, is just gross makeup, right? Like, and being really, like, really, really good at it.
Yeah, but some of it sells better. Like, this was really good.
And it's actually kind of like, for a Hammer film, it's kind of very unbloody. I mean, there is some, but there's not much compared to other sort of Hammer films, which are kind of very kind of blood heavy. In that special Hammer shade of red. Of which no human has ever bled ever.
They're using the entire blood budget over for Dracula.
Yeah, that's probably right, actually. Yeah, there is a lot in Dracula. There's a lot in Dracula, Prince of Darkness, which we definitely need to get around to doing at some point, because it's basically Hammer does Scooby-Doo. So, certainly the first half of it is.
That sounds awesome.
Like two men and two women on a kind of coach trip through Romania stop off at a mysterious, creepy castle, and I swear that, like, because there's a butler called Clove, who's played by Philip Mason, who looks like a drawn Scooby-Doo villain. Yeah, just like the Scooby-Doo kind of henchman guy. Yeah, the generic Scooby-Doo henchman guy.
Five Doctors Rassilon.
Yeah.
Philip Latham. I can't believe I remembered that name, but yes. And yeah, and you're absolutely right, he does look like, you know, old Farmer Jenkins.
Yeah, and like, even more so when he's in this film. And there's a protracted thing of walking around the creepy house for creepy things and finding secret passages. It's Scooby-Doo.
Van Helsing said jinkies. It must be a clue.
So, yeah, I mean, for a movie, and again, I know that, again, it's Hammer, so there's always going to be a certain amount of this. But for a movie made in the 1950s, and I think that this is very much an American versus England dichotomy. This film has a lot of it's not even implied, it's stating it's happening, but there's a lot of sex in this movie. There's a lot of bare people's backs in this movie, which is incredible. Like, you know, you can't make a movie about Rasputin and not show that he's Russia's greatest love machine, basically. But it's still kind of remarkable to watch. Unless what?
Unless it's Anastasia.
Yes, true. I, for one, was deeply disappointed in Anastasia for that very reason.
Finally, the Don Bluth sex scene we've all been waiting for.
Yeah,
I mean, I've watched the Dragon's Lair 2 like playthrough so many times, so I'm like, you could have done that, Don Bluth. I mean, not with Anastasia, but with, like, I don't know, with the Queen or something. Grandma. I mean, Angela Lansbury can be sexy.
I do love the fact that, like, when you see the palace ball for the first time, you know, that's clearly stock footage from a more expensive film. Yes. That probably came from Nicholas and Alexander or something. Mm-hmm. You just see the long shot of the ball and just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's not happening. That wasn't filmed for this. That's quite lavish, and the costumes are pretty accurate.
And then immediately cuts to, like, you know, the corner of a set where there's, you know, two people just kind of talking. Yeah.
Oh, I'm bored of this bourgeois party. Why don't we go somewhere more fun? And go, oh, I want to go to the place where people get drunk and fight.
But again, you can't get on Hammer for being Hammer.
No. Oh, absolutely not. No. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's part of what makes Hammer work. Yeah, it's part of the fun of watching a good Hammer film. And well, I think, yeah, this is a good Hammer film, but it's not a great Hammer film. I think partly because, as everybody said, it is, without Christopher Lee, it's nothing. Like, without that performance, and as you say, sort of like the rare moments he's not on the screen, you sort of lose interest and drift away because not much is happening. But yeah, and then you get to the magnificent Christopher Lee death scene of him just sort of like, because Boris has poisoned everything. He said, like, don't drink that, it's poisoned. Don't eat that, don't sit on that, it's poisoned. Don't touch that doorknob, it's poisoned.
And I even poisoned Guildenstern and Rosencrantz.
But he sits down, sort of casually flings off the top of a box of chocolates, and then pretends sort of not to notice it for a while. Mm-hmm. Then looks and goes, oh, treats for Rasputin. But then just starts tucking in. And then yeah, we get kind of like, the incredible kind of I've been poisoned death acting of Christopher Lee. And the kind of the kind of death scene, which obviously kind of calls to mind that kind of Austin Powers. Why won't you die?
Well, I mean, that's biblically accurate.
Yeah.
Gregory Rasputin. You know, it took an awful lot to keep him down.
Yep. I guess sort of like all the heavy drinking at the start is sort of a Chekhov's constitution. We're showing that early on that he can take it, pretty much anything that sort of tanks into him and it has very little effect.
He definitely put all his points into constitution.
And charisma.
Yep. Yes.
But yeah, that, as you say, that is like it's a fun watch, but actually in terms of, you know, is there an in-depth discussion to be had about this? Probably not. It's that kind of horror B picture where you watch it, you remember it. Yeah. I mean, like me and after we watched it for the first time, me and Gillian spent ages just occasionally shouting at each other, I accept the challenge. One or the other of us would ask the other one to do something.
But I would, and I think we're in agreement though, it's definitely worth watching.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely 100% worth watching just because Christopher Lee is just amazing in this movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is one that probably flew under a lot of people's radar. Like, it would have flown under mine if I hadn't bought the box set. I probably wouldn't have been aware that it existed. So I was obviously very pleased that I discovered it, and I'm happy to have been able to share it with the crew.
With the tranquility of rural England shattered by civil war, evil was spawned at a time of strife in the land.
Take him, Stern. Look for the devil's marks upon him. Right. Albert, you dope.
Pounding the innocent in violence and terror, this evil man showed no mercy in the pursuit and interrogation of his victims. He was called the Witchfinder General. And amidst the horror of the witch hunt, a story of tender young love.
Didn't your uncle just say you must herd it to bed?
He did.
And isn't he a wise man?
He is.
But even their innocence is cruelly corrupted by the vile touch of the Witchfinder General.
My motive in coming here was to find the truth.
Vincent Price is the Witchfinder General. Lust and greed were his only gods.
The money from the magistrate. 9 guineas in silver.
Good. Now we can leave.
Ian Ogilvy as Richard Marshall. He stood alone against the forces of devilish destruction.
And 'tis in thy sight, O Lord, that I hereby swear I shall not rest from the pursuit of his murderers till they stand before thee, ready to answer to thee for their sins.
Rupert Davies as John Lowes.
Master Marshall, welcome.
Patrick Wymark as Oliver Cromwell.
Amongst the most pleasurable aspects of victory, gentlemen, is the opportunity it affords to reward valor. It ranks almost with good food.
And Wilfrid Bramble.
And what line of business might you be in?
God's business. Witch-finding.
Witch-finding. Oh, that's nice. That's very nice.
And introducing Hilary Dwyer as Sarah. Filmed in authentic detail and photographed with piercing realism against the actual background of peaceful villages and quiet countryside. Never has England looked so beautiful, yet been so violent.
I'm your man friend. John Stern, they call me.
Man's inhumanity to man portrayed on the screen so vividly that you flinch. So real that you too will fear the Witchfinder General. Be the first to see it. Be the first to talk about it. The Witchfinder General.
All right, and next up, we sort of kind of kept things rolling with the church figures we don't want to actually pay too much attention to / movies helmed by I guess, Silver Age horror greats with Witchfinder General. Was this anybody's first time seeing this?
Mine.
Okay. Awesome. Wendy, I know that this has long been a movie that you've championed. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Witchfinder General and your thoughts
on its
subject matter?
Strap in, folks.
So The Witchfinder General, it's a 1968 British film. It's a folk horror, and it's brought to us by Tag on British Films. It stars Vincent Price in the lead as Matthew Hopkins, the Witchfinder General. In the film, he's out in the country witchfinding. He has some sort of a license to go out into communities to find people who are being accused of witchcraft, to attempt to get confessions through any means legal. These means are the things he does are actually legal at the time. Kills a lot of people, collects a lot of money, and it's just an absolute, complete, and total shit. In the U.S., the film was released as The Conqueror Worm. It has nothing to do with the poem, The Conqueror Worm, except that they have Vincent Price read it over the credits so that they can kind of cash in on the Vincent Price in movies based on Edgar Allan Poe stories craze at the time. The movie itself, it's not super gory, right? There's some blood, like blood that no human has ever bled before. It centers around Hopkins coming into town. He's brought in to hunt some witches, and it's all political, right? Like, they're hunting. He's the accused in the town is a Catholic priest at a time when Catholics are under attack, and he and some other locals are tried and ultimately killed for witchcraft. But Hopkins fancies a beautiful young woman who lives at the rectory, has been raised by the priest, and harasses her to the point where she basically agrees to give him sex in exchange for not killing the priest. It's a horrible relationship, but it is keeping the priest safe. Eventually, his assistant, who is much, much worse, comes in and attacks her, rapes her, and violently rapes her. And as a result, Hopkins decides she's betrayed him and then kills the fucking priest. Because he really truly is like one of history's greatest monsters. He's a really horrible shit person. There's also a love story between the woman Sarah and her soldier fiance, who eventually comes and tries to save her. And he kind of goes off to hunt Hopkins while he's also on his mission to find and capture he's got orders directly from Cromwell to go out and find and capture the king and bring him justice, while and on that quest he goes off to find Sarah and Hopkins instead. He of course finds Sarah. There's a big ridiculous fight at the end between the soldier and Hopkins, and he bludgeons him to death with a very dull axe. While Vincent Price's stunt double rolls around, kind of, ow, that hurts. The film itself is, I feel like I'm underselling it because I'm excited to talk about Hopkins, the historical asshole. but it's actually really good. Like, there's the love story is really good between the soldier, whose name I don't remember, and Sarah, the young woman. He loves her, even though he loves her knowing that she's been harmed by these men at a time when many men would just sort of cast a woman aside as dirty. Like, that's, she tells him, and his immediate response is just to kind of kneel with her in the desecrated church and just, you know, pray to God and to bless their union, and considers the man in life, and he protects her, and he gives her money, and he sends her away. Tragically, he sends her to exactly where Hopkins is going next, and Hopkins sees her, which is how this whole thing kind of unfolds. The film itself was a super low budget movie, right? And I don't think it did that great. But here, at least here in the US, it's definitely a cult movie. And made a ton in rentals. It's a really great folk horror classic. And it's based on the actual historical asshole Matthew Hopkins. Hopkins was born in 1620, and he died at the age of 25, so he died much, much younger than he's portrayed by Vincent Price in this film. He did get a license to go out and hunt witches, and he did that. And some of the things that are portrayed in this film are things he actually did. Like, he created swimming witches, which they do in this film, which they drown people. They basically dunk people in water, and if they drown, then they were innocent. But if they swim or float, then clearly they are and must be killed. They also invented pricking, which we see a lot of in this movie. His assistant has this horrible little tool that looks like a really pointy screwdriver, and he would jam it in people. Because the idea was if they'd stabbed, if you had a what he believed to be a witch's mark. So Hopkins kind of created this idea that witches made a pact with the devil. Because the devil has that kind of time to go out into rural England and make individual pacts with young women and old ladies. And in doing so, they would somehow nurse him from a spot on their body, and that would create a witch's mark. And if you poked that, it wouldn't bleed. And so in the film, when we see his assistant like stabbing these women with this thing, he's trying to show that they won't bleed if he pokes them. So they did this, but they had fucking fake prickers that would retract like a children's toy, so they could demonstrate, I can poke you here and you not bleed, so clearly you are a witch. Got a lot of confessions. So he had a lot of horrific things that he was allowed to do under his, he had a license that allowed him to do this. He created starving people, keeping people awake, walking people. Like, they show them running the priest in this to try and get a confession of him, but that's not how they ran people. They would actually like tie them up so that they're like one, like your left wrist would be tied to your right ankle and vice versa. And then you would be forced to run in that position. And I think I could do one lap around the table like that. Things like that would get a lot of confessions out of people. He was involved in 200 accusations and 71 deaths. Thankfully, he died young. He was a piece of shit. And his life story is collected in an amazing book published in 1894 called The Lives of 12 Bad Men, which is actually a really fun read if you can get your hands on it.
I also discovered that apparently his treatise, which is a discovery of witches, wasn't that big in England, but was taken over to the colonies and was formed the basis of a lot of the stuff that was around the Salem witch trials.
Yeah, and actually the Salem witch trials, so something that Matthew Hopkins believed, like he was primarily active, I believe, in the region of Essex, and he believed that the devil was in Essex specifically because he was there, and the devil hated him so much that he was there. And that is the exact same thing that Cotton Mather believed in the Salem trials. Cotton Mather believed that the devil was in Salem because he was in Salem, and he was such a worthy adversary of the devil. And he published a treatise in 1647, and it was used in Salem. And also his techniques, the things that he did, became standard witch hunting practices and spread throughout continental Europe as well.
Awesome. Well, not awesome, but thank you, Wendy, for going through all of that. Yeah, not a good guy. And I know that we'll talk some about that as well as we talk about the movie and the history of how it was made. Dave, so this was your first time seeing it?
Yeah, it's kind of always been on my get around to watching list because obviously, yeah, it's a British folk horror movie. And I think as we've well established, that's kind of my jam. But yeah, just for one reason or another, due to sort of, you know, not having, being able to get around to see it or not being available to watch or whatever. Yeah, I've just never got around to it. So yeah, I was kind of looking forward to this as a first watching. And yeah, it's pretty gruesome, obviously. And in a way, it's a good thing because it does show all the horrible things that this person did in the name of, well, yeah, whatever he thought he was doing, basically. Obviously, Vincent Price is Vincent Price. And it's extremely good, and like he definitely looks the part in the kind of like the Puritan gear. Ian Ogilvy is very great as well. The saint as a roundhead soldier. Just from a kind of British history perspective, he was sort of funny hearing like Naseby being mentioned casually as a mild skirmish, but it's off over there and no one really talks about it. Like, for a historical equivalent, it's like, imagine this film was American and they were just kind of offhandedly mentioning Gettysburg, just as a side thing that was kind of taking place, but nobody's really paying much attention to it. Like Naseby was like the battle of the English Civil War. That was kind of like, yeah, just amusing. To like, we're acknowledging that, yeah, this is taking place during the English Civil War, but we're not actually going to show you any of that. It'd be far too expensive. we've just got a few costumes. But yeah, I think the supporting cast is great. I'm a big fan of Nicky Henson, who plays kind of Eno Gouveia's army friend, while the guy goes to rescue him at the end. He's a really good sort of charismatic little character actor who was in a lot of stuff in the 60s and 70s, both film and television. Yeah, in fact, it was fun to see Alf Joint, his name in the opening credits, because he was a very prolific stunt performer in the United Kingdom. Been in all sorts of things from sort of Star Wars, Superman, and stuff like this over sort of many, many years. So it was kind of fun to see his name in the... one of those, Alf Joint!
Yeah, there's a lot of really great character actors in this movie. Like, Matthew Hopkins is like brought to town and paid by Sabalom Glitz.
Yep.
Tony Selby.
And of course, we get Wilfred Bramble turning up in a brief cameo as a. he's basically Johnny McCartney if he was a horse salesman during the English Civil War.
That was so great.
Paul McCartney's granddad. Yeah, he was in this. And yeah, he was. He was absolutely like in Johnny McCartney mode.
Yeah. The only thing missing was a flat cap and everyone saying how clean he was.
Yeah.
Chicken sandwiches.
So yeah, like, it's a dark old ending. I mean, I genuinely thought they were going to shoot Ian Ogilvy at the end because it looked like, yeah, because obviously he's gone completely batshit Coco Bananas crazy after killing Hopkins, and then sort of Nicky Henson just sort of basically shoots Hopkins to put him out of his misery. And he gets, you know, he goes sort of like, you took him from me! And I thought they were going to have to shoot him as well because, like, he was, like, just so deranged by that point. But, yeah, so I suppose, like, another variation on the Hammer end card is Screaming Woman. Because again, just sort of like, but in a way, it's sort of fitting because, like, yeah, this is a film about the anguish and torture of women throughout that age. So the fact that it ends on the anguished screams of a tortured woman is sort of apt and sort of like, yeah, very much the encapsulation of everything, you know, that was nasty about this awful piece of shit human being.
Awesome. Will, tell me what you were thinking.
So, the film is a very nasty piece of work. Like, in a lot of ways, it is a precursor to the Eli Roth torture porn kind of films. There isn't a lot of blood, but a lot of the film is just, here is all these ways these people are being horribly tortured by Matthew Hopkins. And whereas in Rasputin is kind of seducing the audience, so like, here, like, we are watching Vincent Price do all this shit, and all you can think of the entire movie is, I can't wait to see this fucker die. And yeah, honestly, like, Vincent, this is one of Vincent Price's most interesting performances, because he's kind of playing, like, really hammy, and there's a hamminess to it, yeah, but, and I mean, he's the one person without a British accent in the entire film, but like overall, like still there, he is just like so sinister. You can tell that he does not believe in a bit of what he's doing here. It's all about the money. It's all about the sex. And yeah, you know, I get my jollies off on killing some people in the process. I think if the part of Matthew Hopkins had been played a lot more straight, I don't think I would have enjoyed the film as much as I did. I would have felt like how I feel like watching any of Eli Roth's films and felt disgusting watching it. Instead, I'm like, okay, you know what? I want to see this fucker die. Let's go.
It's interesting you say that, because apparently the director didn't want Vincent Price. He wanted Donald Pleasance.
And, I couldn't have seen that.
The thing is, they tailored the script for Pleasance. So he was intended to be quieter, more reserved, more kind of pent up.
Kind of a hapless dipshit, actually, who just kind of let things get away from him. Mm. And that Stearns was the real monster behind everything.
But it's not historically right. Hopkins was the monster. And Hopkins was really young. You know, he died when he was 25, and he had a reign of terror. You know, I'm thinking about this. I think Hopkins might be our one of our earliest documented cases of incel violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think one of the good things about it is that it is uncomfortable, because and a lot of this happened, and you should feel uncomfortable watching this, because this isn't being, unlike a lot of the kind of torture porn stuff you mentioned, Will, the stuff on display here isn't being presented to thrill or terrify. It's being shown to show, dear God, this was awful. In a way, I want to say it doesn't glamorize it, but I suppose it does a bit just for kind of the spectacle of it being a film, but it never lingers unnecessarily. Like when you see the woman being kind of like lowered into the flames, you see it from a distance, like she catches fire, she goes into flames, and then it's gone. There isn't like a long lingering thing on the burning corpse. So like you see it happen and it's over, and you are shocked and it's awful, but it's never it never feels overtly exploitative. It's more just sort of showing this is a horrible thing that happened.
Yeah. Like that scene that you're talking about, Dave, is one of the best scenes in the movie, because they're slowly lowering this woman into the flames, and she is screaming until she's very suddenly not. And she continues to be lowered into the fire. And that is like, for me, that was extremely upsetting in a good way, like in terms of it drove home what the movie was trying to drive home. My understanding is that, you know, again, the AIP insists, because AIP put up most of the money for this movie, even though Tygon was the actual production company. They said, we want you to use Vincent Price. We don't want you to use Donald Pleasance. You know, you're taking our money. You're taking our actor, basically. And so they had to rewrite him to be a lot more of a Vincent Price character. And I guess Vincent Price wanted to play it the way that Vincent Price always plays, just dripping in ham. And he got into a lot of arguments with the director. The director was like, I want you to play this absolutely straight. You are a fucking monster. You are not here to be funny. You are not here to be sympathetic. You are here to brutally torture and murder people for money and pride. And I guess they had a huge, huge rouse throughout the entire movie. And then Vincent Price finally saw the movie and was just like, oh, okay. Like, that was absolutely the right call. Because
I did hear one of the rows between them kind of basically went, Vincent Price saying, I've made 89 films, dear boy, how many have you made? And he said, two, but they're good.
It's one of those things that's harsher in hindsight as well, because the director, Michael Reeves, dies like a couple months later. And
and I guess the original script was in fact a lot gorier. They wanted to make this a much gorier movie initially, and again the producer says, absolutely not, we need to be able to sell this in America, we need to be able to, you know. So they toned it down, oddly enough, the gore of it. But I think in doing so, that just strengthened the moral awfulness of the entire affair. I will say this. One of the movies that I very strongly considered instead of Witchfinder General was Mark of the Devil, which is basically this. But what if that was directed by Herschel Gordon Lewis? Like, what if we had the scenes with the women being tortured, but we're pulling sausages out of a topless lady's midsection kind of thing, you know?
Jesus.
And I would say that movie is fun, but in a way that is like, this is all very silly and over the top, kind of way. And I think that this movie works much better because it's so restrained in that sense.
Yeah, like it never feels like the violence is exploitative.
Yeah,
I don't think. Like,
it's bad like, enough to show you how terrible it is, but not entertaining in any way.
Yeah,
like, having said
like you should be going, oh, that bit's, you know, it's not like watching Machete or something, but you see somebody getting dismembered, like their intestines are getting thrown up into a helicopter's rotor blades. You know, so like where you're going, oh yeah, that's cool, man, that's ridiculous.
Exactly.
Like, you know, but this is meant to, you know, this is meant to be as uncomfortable and unflinching as what was done was. You know, and that feels right for this subject matter. I think, like, had it gone in a more exploitative direction, I just think, like, the tone would have been wrong. And I think that's why this works, is because, like, you know, it treats it seriously. It treats what was done seriously. And it treats Hopkins as a genuinely unpleasant, irredeemable character.
Yeah, and I mean, just to kind of get into my own thoughts, is that I really enjoy this movie quite a bit because it's so... It does elicit a strong reaction in me, in a good way, partly because Vincent Price is not Vincent Pricing it up, right? He is playing it as straight as I think he's capable of playing a role like this. And I say that loving Vincent Price. I really enjoy Vincent Price. But normally he's, you know, it does not take a lot of imagination to convince him to play Batman villain. And he's not doing that here.
I like Vincent Price, but he can be Vincent Price.
Yeah. And yeah, he's just giving an amazing performance. And he's surrounded by other people that are also giving amazing performances. John Stern is, and I don't remember the actor's name, unfortunately, but he's a great character. You know, he's just a pure thug, and he plays that part extremely well.
I like the relationship between the two of them as well, but he keeps trying to call Hopkins Matthew, and mm-hmm. he's like, we're not friends. Don't talk to me like you're people.
Yeah. Yeah. Ian Ogilvy is wonderful. I think he does a great job. And Hillary Dwyer. Is that her name?
I think so, she's
great. She's wonderful in this. I know that she kind of went on to much bigger status as a producer. She didn't do a lot of acting, but she's great in this as well.
Yeah, she has to go through a real gamut of emotions and performances. So, you know, obviously you have to see her sort of like happy at the start with Ogilvy and, you know, kind of going, yeah, because you have to see how everything's going to go horribly wrong. And then when she's kind of like, I don't want to say seducing, but she kind of has to in terms of Hopkins in order to try and save the priest's life, when she's trying to sort of like, you know, play into him and his sort of vanity. And then obviously her terror, her assault, and her obviously scream, suffering in the torture chamber at the end. She gets, she goes on a real emotional roller coaster, and I think it's a really good performance.
Yeah, and I also like the look of the movie quite a bit. The movie takes advantage of the English countryside, and it looks really nice, except that it is kind of gray and dour throughout the entire movie. And I think that's basically this movie in a nutshell, right? It's all very pretty, but it's also kind of depressing and not as attractive as it, you know, you might normally think in a movie like this, you know.
Curiosity, how much awareness do you guys have of the English Civil War?
I was actually just about to get into that.
Yeah.
I will say that we, in my history class, I had like a ninth grade, like freshman history class of world history. And we might have spent 2 days on the English Civil War. And it basically boiled down to, you know what? Charles II was an enormous asshole, but to be fair, so was Oliver Cromwell.
Yeah, about the same.
That's 2 days more than I got. I know from, like, because I'm addicted to like British history videos on YouTube. So that's my education.
I'm friends with some Irish people, and I know Oliver Cromwell is the devil.
Yeah, no, he was not a nice man. I mean, like, a very talented general, a very good strategist, but a hideous human being. I do like the fact that when the monarchy was eventually restored, they dug Cromwell up and executed him. Because Cromwell was dead by this point. They dug him up, executed him, and put his skull on a spike.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that historically that's sometimes a thing. Like, bodies get dug up and tried and re-executed. Yeah.
In fact, if you go to the British Museum in the kind of like that kind of British history part of it, you know, the stuff we haven't stolen has Oliver Cromwell's death mask. Was it, you know, like that weird thing they used to do of taking kind of impressions of famous people's face. So you actually, you know, you can see what Cromwell actually looked like. And it's kind of a weird part of Britain. Not weird, but like, it's that kind of bridge between sort of the obviously historical royalty of old and Britain becoming a constitutional monarchy, which obviously it still is today. So kind of that was like, yeah, that part of our history is very much that kind of like turning point between the sort of ye olde kings and queens who ruled with absolute power and us actually having a parliament, and that was, yeah, the thing. And the fact that, Cromwell was actually succeeded as Lord Protector of Britain by his son, Richard Cromwell, who was not the ruler his father was, both in terms of keeping power and, but theoretically, had there been a different, you know, had he been a stronger ruler, or had somebody else been picked, we could still be a protectorate.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's one of those kind of, you know, those like turning points in history where people do kind of historical fictions, you know, like, you know, what if such and such had happened? There's a few bits out there of sort of what if the Puritans had remained in control of it? You know, the monarchy was never restored and basically Britain had become a republic.
You know, actually, I tell a lie. Most of what I know about Oliver Cromwell does come from the John Cleese song. Born in 1599 and died in 1658, December.
Wasn't a fan of Christmas. The man banned mince pies.
Well, you know, they got sick of the Puritans and they sent them over here, and that's who founded us, and that's why we're so fucked up.
Yeah.
And they brought their witch hunting ways to us. I would say one thing that I maybe didn't kind of gloss over is Hopkins did have like a license to go witch hunting, but it didn't really say what he thought it said. It wasn't really authorized. I think it was much more limited in scope, but he kind of ran with it. And there was so much chaos because of the background of the Civil War, that he could just, like, the courts weren't happening, which is why he was able to go out and do these trials himself. Like, the court system was shut down or really limited in scope at that time. And he was able to go off, and his power was unchecked, and he took advantage of it.
Yeah, because basically we had the government, because Parliament had been shut down because Charles declared absolute power, and so there was no infrastructure. Well, like you say, kind of like, and like the film says at the start, kind of law and order, yeah, in terms of sort of like laws being handed down from a government, which are then enforced, and there is being a system of enforcing them didn't exist to a greater or less degree. It was all kind of like local. It would be like local magistrates and justices of the peace and stuff, and it kind of depended on who your local one was, depending on whether or not you basically they let nutters in and burn people as witches.
Yeah, and so some local folks would just kind of say, "We really want to get rid of these people. We want their land. We want whatever they have. Let's get some money together, and this guy will come in and he will take care of our problem for us. Our hands will be clean. We'll testify against them, and we'll get whatever they had. We'll go in and desecrate that church and take everything of value."
And I know that the title of Witchfinder General was something he just sort of came up with on his own. He had a license, but he was not in any way
the local Witchfinder. He was not the Witchfinder General.
Like, oh, can we see your card? Yeah, to see my card.
I can't read anyway.
Like, there wasn't a Witchfinder army of which he could be general of.
Witchfinder general just makes me think it's like some, it's a pharmacy.
or a hospital.
Yeah.
That's what the Salem Hospital should be called now.
It's a discount witch supply store.
Come down for Witchfinder General this week. Buy one, get one free on Eyes of Newt.
It's Spirit Halloween's main competitor.
No. It's like Dollar General. But I can buy a dead man's toe.
Yeah.
Honestly, somebody should totally run with that and open a Halloween store called Witchfinder General.
Well, if anybody does off the back of this, then, I don't know, send us a dollar for the idea.
I mean, I would just take, you know, a couple free pumpkins every year.
So, we've seen this. We've seen the Wicker Man. Can the blood on Satan's claw be far behind?
I want to do the whole entire Unholy Trilogy.
I mean, it would be unfair not to at this point, wouldn't it? I mean,
yeah. Well, it's got Zoe from Doctor Who in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, because I know we first mentioned that when we were talking about Midsummer, and I feel like in a way this is kind of spiritually similar, insofar as the, again, like in Midsummer, the violence is extreme for the film of the time, but it never feels exploitative, but necessary for the story, you know, and it's the thing that's kind of drawing you into that kind of whole, where the general dread of the tale it's telling.
I don't remember the name of the film theorist, but I know that we talked about it. We talked about Midsommar and the Wicker Man, and he has popularized this theory of like the folk horror chain and the kind of codifying like what are the three Unholy Trinity films in the original wave of folk horror. And that's exactly what they are. Like the Wicker Man, it's this, the Witchfinder General, and the Blood on Satan's Claw. And when Ari Aster made Midsommar, he is absolutely informed by all of that, by all of those things, not just the Wicker Man, but the entire batch of those, especially those three films, but also like the original folk horror films. They all have
You can watch Midsommar and definitely see the Wicker Man in there. But at the same time, the violence in Midsommar very much, to me, seems to be coming from this movie. And the way that it's used not to go, oh, sick, but to make you feel bad.
And the targeting of the woman, the powerlessness of the woman around, you know, and all of the behavior around her, everything's happening to her and she doesn't have any control over it.
And the ultimate kind of comeuppance of the men who are responsible for the torturing of the women, you know. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, again, it's what Florence Pugh's boyfriend is the Matthew Hopkins of that film, really. It's like, you know, he is responsible for all of her pain and suffering, although obviously in Midsommar it's more psychological than it is physical. But it's the same kind of dynamic in a way.
I do say that for everything that happened, I kind of actually wish that his death at the end was worse.
Yeah.
He does seem to get off easy.
Yeah, I feel like he's bludgeoned by a dull axe. There's no gore. There's no hacking. I would have liked to see a little bit of.
You want to see Vincent Price's head roll down the stairs?
I want to see like the wax and plaster head, like with the little bob and the hat roll down the stairs.
In fact, there's another Hammer kind of folk horror-y film that might be worth watching at some point called The Witches, which is written by Nigel Neal of Quatermass fame. And yeah, he's sort of like a contemporary 60s tale of witches, and there's lots of kind of sort of like interpretive dance and channeling of energies and stuff. But that's very much in a similar vein as well.
Well, thank you everybody for being on. Thank you people listening. This was really fun. Again, two movies that I think that we all, you know, all agree. Maybe I know that Will had a tough time with the second one, but very wholeheartedly recommend. But please take care of yourselves. Please drink some water. Please go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. I have been asked by the general manager at WHXN Channel 37 not to say anything about church figures that will get us in any hot water. I wasn't sure what they meant until they brought out my file. Did you know you can fit 3 whole reams of paper in those folders?
Okay, and Wendy, you said you'd be okay with running with this one?
Please.
Yeah, okay.
Please let me talk about Matthew Hopkins, actual historical asshole.
Yeah, absolutely.